as a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart that you can't take part, you can't even passively take part, and you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop, and you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Mario Savio speaking on the steps of Sproul Hall during the historic sit-ins on the University of California at Berkeley campus in 1964. Those are the most often remembered and cited words from the 3 months of protests for free speech. This was the moment of the free speech movement, and as fate had it, everything was happening only a few blocks from Pacifica's first station, KPFA. And in late 1964 through early 1965, KPFA produced a gripping and incredibly informative documentary on the protests. This week on From the Vault, we'll hear excerpts from that documentary, and we'll also speak to Professor Robert Cohen, the co-editor of the 2002 book, The Free Speech Movement, Reflections on Berkeley in the 1960s, and author of a book he's still working on concerning the political life of Mario Savio. Cohen, a scholar of American student protest movements, received his doctorate in history from UC Berkeley in 1987. I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives, and here's KPFA's 1964 radio documentary entitled, Is Freedom Academic?
I saw them ducking. They're advancing with their nightsticks in the front. I haven't seen anything particularly violent.
We have an autocracy which runs this university. It's managed. We were told the following. If President Kerr actually tried to get something more liberal out of the regents in his telephone conversations, why didn't he make some public statement to that effect? And the answer we received from a well-meaning liberal was the following. He said, would you ever imagine the manager of a firm making a statement publicly in opposition to his board of directors? That's the answer. Well, I ask you to consider, if this is a firm, and if the Board of Regents are the Board of Directors, and if President Kerr, in fact, is the manager, then I tell you something, the faculty are a bunch of employees, and we're the raw materials, but we're a bunch of raw materials that don't mean to be have any process upon us, don't mean to be made into any product, don't mean to end up being bought by some clients of the university, be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone. We're human beings.
Wednesday, December 2nd, 1964. That was Mario Savio, student and leader of the free speech movement at the University of California at Berkeley. His words preceded a sit-in and strike led by students against the administration of the university, the climax of nearly 3 months of negotiations, protests, and demonstrations. In mid-September, the Dean of Students informed student political organizations that they would no longer be allowed to use the campus to solicit funds or to advocate off-campus political activity. The ban covered organizations ranging from civil rights groups to Students for Goldwater, Young Democrats, Young Republicans, and the Young Socialist Alliance. Most of these groups, about 20 in all, coalesced into a coordinating organization, the Free Speech Movement, or FSM. For 2 weeks, the students negotiated with university officials in an attempt to have the regulation rescinded. Then, on September 30th, some students set out to violate the regulation. Their actions culminated in the demonstrations of October 1st and 2nd, during which students surrounded a police car for more than 30 hours and refused to allow police to remove from the campus and book a former student who had joined in violating regulations. At the end of the demonstrations, student representatives and University President Clark Kerr reached agreement that
the student demonstrators shall desist from all forms of their illegal protest against university regulations. Number two, a committee representing students, including leaders of the demonstration, faculty and administration, will immediately be set up to conduct discussions and hearing into all aspects of political behavior on campus and its control, and to make recommendations to the administration. Three, the arrested man will be booked but released on his own recognizance. And the university, which is the complainant, will not press charges. This is for the duration of the suspension of the suspended students will be submitted within 1 week to the Student Conduct Committee of the Academic Senate, not to the administration. Five, activity may be continued by student organizations in accordance with existing university regulations.
The agreement solved nothing. The day after it was signed, the university announced that there was no such committee as the Committee on Student Conduct of the Academic Senate, and that the cases of the suspended students would be submitted to a committee appointed by the chancellor, the chief administrative officer on the Berkeley campus. Negotiations began again, and demonstrations resumed. On November 20th, the Board of Regents adopted a policy statement under which all of the previously banned activities would be allowed, but the administration would be empowered to take disciplinary action against students who advocated unlawful off-campus activity. The students responded that allowing disciplinary action for advocacy of unlawful activity placed them in double jeopardy, and that the effect of the policy statement was to rule in advance that certain kinds of advocacy were illegal, thus violating the First and 14th Amendments to the United States Constitution. Demonstrations continued. On November 27th, Chancellor Edward Strong sent four students letters which became the catalysts of the demonstrations which ended December 3rd. The Chancellor informed the four students that they would be required to attend hearings before the Committee on Student Conduct on charges of illegal activity during the demonstrations of October 1st and 2nd. On December 1st, the free speech movement announced that a round-the-clock sit-in would be held in Sproul Hall, the administration building of the Berkeley campus, if the university did not meet three demands by noon December 2nd. The demands were that charges against the four students be dropped, that the university guarantee to take no further action against students, and that university regulations be revised so that only the courts would regulate the content of political expression, that the faculty, students, and administration would jointly regulate the form of political expression, and that university regulations which unnecessarily restrict political activity would be repealed. The demands were not met. At noon on Wednesday, December 2nd, 4,000 to 5,000 persons attended a rally on the steps of Sproul Hall. The main speaker was Mario Savio.
There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Following Savio's speech, Joan Baez spoke, sang, and led a crowd of 1,100 into the building to begin the sit-in.
The only thing that occurs to me, seeing all you people there, I don't know how many of you intend to come inside with us, but that is that you muster up as much love as you possibly can, and as little hatred, and as little violence, and as little angries as you can, although I know it's been exasperating. The more love you can feel, the more chance there is for it to be a success.
Inside, the students discussed what might happen to them.
I'm going to give instructions for all the contingencies. Nobody should be standing if the police come to eject us. When the police touch you, we request you to do two things. To ask if you're under arrest and to go limp. And it's very easy to go limp. You just sort of... It's very easy to go limp. It's the easiest thing to do at that time. Now, if you are under arrest, it's going to be very easy. They're going to pick you up and carry you in a paddy wagon. No more instructions are necessary. In terms of what goes on down there, going down there, you give me your name and your address, and that's all. But more likely, they'll eject you. When you're carried out of the building and you're sat down, we're asking you not to get up then and trot off home. We're asking you to sit where you're left, or if anything, sit nearer to the door. So I repeat, we don't want any linking arms. We don't want any fighting with the cops. We don't want anybody hurt or any violent incidents.
At 7 p.m., the doors were closed, and police announced that anyone who remained in the building did so in violation of the law. But the police made no attempt to remove the students. The students showed films. A Hanukkah service was held, ending with a Hatikva. There were classes ranging from a lecture on James Joyce to instruction on civil disobedience. About midnight, most students prepared to go to sleep. At about the same time, Governor Edmund Brown announced, "I have tonight called upon the law enforcement officials in Alameda County to arrest and take into custody all students and others who may be in violation of the law at Sproul Hall. I have directed the California Highway Patrol to lend all necessary assistance. These orders are to be carried out peacefully as a demonstration that the rule of law must be honored in California." The university had not yet issued any statement on the sit-in, but about 1 a.m. the students were awakened with the news that Chancellor Strong was coming with an official statement. He arrived about 3 a.m.
"May I have your attention, please? I am Dr. Edward Strong, Chancellor of the Berkeley campus. I have an announcement. This assemblage has developed to such a point that the purpose and work of the university have been materially impaired. It is clear that there have been acts of disobedience and illegality which cannot be tolerated in a responsible educational center and would not be tolerated anywhere in our society. The university has shown great restraint and patience in exercising its legitimate authority in order to allow every opportunity for expressing differing points of view. The university always stands ready to engage in the established and accepted procedures for resolving differences of opinion. I request that each of you cease your participation in this unlawful assembly. I urge you, both individually and collectively, to leave this area. I request that you immediately disperse. Failure to disperse will result in disciplinary action by the university. Please go."
"Your attention, please. This is Lieutenant M.F. Chandler of the University of California Police Department. A condition of unlawful assemblage now exists under authority of Section 726 of the Penal Code of the State of California, and in the name of the people of the State of California, I command you to disperse. I further notify you that all persons who do not immediately disperse are in violation of the California state law and are subject to arrest. You have 5 minutes to leave the building or you will be arrested."
Although the group inside had dwindled by then to about 800, few, if any, students left the building under the 5-minute time limit. In the next half hour, police reinforcements arrived, and about 3:45, the arrests began.
The elevator is stopped here up on the fourth floor. They're using a Polaroid camera, and the police are taking pictures of each of them. Seems that they're not taking chances about misidentification. Looking down the corridor now, I see another demonstrator being picked up off the floor. He also has gone limp. The policemen are trying to lift him up. He slips out from under their arms. They're twisting. One arm is back in a hammerlock. The other arm is bent underneath him. And there, a third policeman has lifted his legs up, and he's been carried face down into the elevator and has been placed on the ground. He's lying on his stomach. I think they're turning him over now. It's hard to see over the crush of people. They're using numbers printed on slips of paper. And the number they're holding up against his chest as they take his photograph is number 7. Another demonstrator is being moved along. This one hasn't gone completely limp, but he's got his coat twisted around him. I guess by his own desire. He seems now in the elevator to have gone limp. Again, there's this struggle to get him set for a picture. He seems to have gone very limp, and he's a fairly tall fellow, so that they're having a hard time. They seem to have got him set now, and there goes the flashbulb. That, according to the count, if that number was accurate, was number 8. Here comes another demonstrator. This one's a young lady. She's gone limp, more or less, but is walking along with them. No, they've carried her. She was lifted off the ground and carried into the elevator. There is a police woman, Berkeley policewoman, who's also entered the elevator with her. I see they have the policewoman along in case any of the young lady demonstrators run into any trouble. They're holding a number 9 up. Picture has been taken again. And a short description or statement. Perhaps they're taking some kind of statement or requesting information. It's being taken. The elevator is now about to descend. The policewoman has left it.
By 7:15, the fourth floor was cleared, but only about 70 students had been arrested. At this point, the pace was accelerated. The highway patrolmen and deputy sheriffs were pressed into service, and the students who had until then been transported to the basement in the elevator were now taken forcibly down the stairs. At about the same time, the police attempted to arrest the leaders of the demonstration. One group of about a dozen policemen made a surprise rush up the main stairs to the second floor, arrested one leader, and took away the microphone of the public address system with which the students had been addressing people outside the building. But there were other leaders and an extra microphone. After that, the students packed in tightly around the window leading to a balcony where the remaining leaders stood to use the PA system. About 8 a.m., police made another rush, this time in greater force.
California patrolmen are moving in, led by an inspector in plain clothes, over the students, over the heads of the students who are seated down. They're moving very swiftly, pushing their way up over the seated demonstrators, stepping on them and kicking them.
The cops have taken out their nightsticks. They're stepping over people. There are just kids sitting there, my God.
One of the California Highway Patrol.
Hey, easy does it, wow.
They've grabbed one kid and pushed him down the steps, beating him on the back of the head. It's a kind of gauntlet. They're kicking them and throwing them down the stairs. I don't know what's happening to these kids, but it looks horrible. They're tugging them by their feet and throwing them down the stairs, literally tossing them down the steps between them. There's a double line of cops directly in front of me. One of the police officials has just come over and shaken his head, said, go on, go on. They've cleared a spot. The cops in front of me are laughing. They've thrown boys and girls down the stairs, their heads jostling and banging against the banisters and marble stairs. One fellow was just going down slowly and was grabbed and pushed. One kid is now being pulled feet first down the stairs. We're reporters at the press. All right, okay. Well, we're moving. Fine, okay. All right. The police have ordered us to get out of the way until they've gotten this cleaned up. We've just about been tossed down the stairs. They're pulling the kids down by their legs. None of the kids that I've seen have fought back in any way whatsoever.
It was after 6 p.m., more than 14 hours after arrest began, before the 635 policemen finished clearing Sproul Hall. The district attorney announced that 780 persons had been arrested, and according to university records, about 80% were students, faculty, or other employees. They were booked on as many as three charges: illegal assembly, failure to disperse, and resisting arrest, a charge which includes going limp when arrested. Bail for those booked on all three charges was set at $110. Friday, December 4th. Professor Henry May, at a press conference held by faculty members of the University of California.
When this whole business started back in September, the starting point for the students was that certain political privileges, collecting money and collecting signatures, were suddenly withdrawn. In the opinion of the students and of a good many of the faculty, the reasons given were not sufficient and were somewhat contradictory. This is what gave rise to the tragic and unfortunate incident involving the police car on October 2nd. After that, a settlement was negotiated, and the fact that a settlement was negotiated seems to me to indicate some admission that there was fault on more than one side. And since then, problems were intensely discussed by a tripartite faculty-student administration committee. These negotiations were not successful and broke down. However, the faculty contingent in that committee made certain complex recommendations for new rules regarding student political action. The recommendations of the faculty groups were praised by spokesmen of the administration. They were, to some extent and in part, accepted by the Board of Regents. In a meeting of the Academic Senate, a majority of the faculty in that meeting upheld the administration, defeated a move to take regulatory powers of this sort from the administration and give it to the faculty. Then last Monday, the administration announced a decision to press for penalties for actions taken 2 months before during the initial crisis. And the students at this point, rightly or wrongly, but I think very understandably, felt that they had been tricked. And it's at this point that far bigger demonstrations broke out than had ever taken place before, that very unpleasant and rough statements were made about entering Sproul Hall and so forth. No measures were taken to prevent the students from entering Sproul Hall, and as a result, they occupied it, and as a result, as you know, the governor called the police.
The announcement of disciplinary action against four students had precipitated larger demonstrations than ever before. The arrests in Sproul Hall made demonstrators and debaters for or against the free speech movement of almost everyone connected with the university. The immediate reaction of the FSM's supporters was to call a student strike and to hold another rally. Both students and faculty members spoke at the rally, and they gained support from three state legislators.
I got a call this morning. Someone asked me if I would like to appear before you and speak.
Assemblyman William Stanton of San Jose.
I was afraid that I might get run over in the crush of public officials coming forward to defend free speech. There have been many things that I haven't liked during my connection with the university. I was here during the famous Boil the Oath controversy of the 50s. The regents, in their infinite wisdom, decided it was time to purify the institution and to drive out the communists. Well, if you go through the court reports, you'll find that the Supreme Court of California held that this was an unconstitutional exercise of power on the part of the regents. It was lawbreaking. It was illegal. but never were the regents put in jail for breaking the law, for destroying a great faculty and humiliating a great institution.
Assemblyman Willie Brown of San Francisco.
Now the responsible people in this state, or the allegedly responsible people in this state, are taking the position that yours is not a worthy cause. They're taking the position that there is nothing wrong with the University of California, that some helmeted highway patrolman and Alameda County Sheriff's Department fellows can't handle. Well, I think that the people in the state of California need to know that there is something seriously wrong with this university when 801 people are dragged bodily downstairs from the administration building of this university and arrested. There's something wrong when faculty members of this university call for the ouster of Chancellor Strong. There's something wrong when some of us ask for the resignation of Clark Kerr. Obviously, there's something wrong with this university that the world needs to know about.
On Sunday, December 6th, the Council of Department Chairmen announced that it had drawn up a proposal which had been approved by President Kerr. On Monday, December 7th, all classes were canceled from 9 a.m. to noon, and a university meeting was held at which the department chairman's proposal was made public. The chairman criticized the FSM, urged ending the strike, and said that the regulations the FSM had criticized should be accepted pending the report of the Academic Senate's Academic Freedom Committee. They also proposed that the university take no disciplinary action against students involved in the political controversy prior to December 3rd, the day the sit-in had ended. But both the free speech movement and a significant portion of the faculty were not satisfied. A group of about 200 faculty members had already drawn up a different sort of proposal for submission to the Academic Senate on Tuesday, December 8th. As presented to the Senate meeting by Professor Joseph Garbarino, chairman of the Academic Freedom Committee, the motion read,
1. That there shall be no university disciplinary measures against members or organizations of the university community for activities prior to December 8th connected with the current controversy over political speech and activity. 2. That the time, place, and manner of conducting political activity on the campus shall be subject to reasonable regulation to prevent interference with the normal functions of the university. That the regulations now in effect for this purpose shall remain in effect provisionally, pending a future report of the Committee on Academic Freedom concerning the minimal regulations necessary. Section 3. That the content of speech or advocacy should not be restricted by the university. Off-campus student political activities shall not be subject to university regulation. On-campus advocacy or organization of such activities shall be subject only to such limitations as may be imposed under Section 2. 4. That future disciplinary measures in the area of political activity shall be determined by a committee appointed by and responsible to the Berkeley Division of the Academic Senate.
Debate on the motion began with seconding speeches.
I will comment only upon point 3. We should regard it and support it as symbolizing the fundamental commitment of the university to its own essential nature, for it expresses the conviction that ours is an institution whose proper mode of dealing with the mind is educational, not coercive. We are not the secular arm. If we have forgotten this, we should be grateful to those who are now reminding us.
We believe that the adoption of this resolution by the Academic Senate is crucial, not only to the solution of the present crisis, but to the survival of the university as a significant institution in American intellectual life. We do not believe the present resolution is perfect. We believe, however, that the resolution comes close to being optimal under the circumstances. I believe that many share my feeling that this resolution is our best, perhaps now, our only hope of settling what has been one of the most agonizing, shattering, and potentially destructive experiences that any American university has ever had to pass through.
Then an amendment was offered and debate resumed.
First line of paragraph 3, to alter it as follows, that the content of speech or advocacy on this campus, provided that it is directed to no immediate act of force or violence, should not be restricted by the university. The particular resolution which we will enact will probably become a model for many of the universities from here to the East Coast and including the state of Mississippi. As this resolution stands now without an amendment, it would allow a student Ku Klux Klan chapter to organize itself on campuses to carry on meetings at which they would advocate, plan, and organize actions for defacing Jewish synagogues, Negro and Catholic churches, and they would claim the protection of the university sanctuary for these acts of speech, advocacy, and organization. Unless we have a provision, some amendment, which will make it clear that we do not condone this sort of action or behavior, we are opening the way for every extremist and crackpot organization which can then enter upon this campus, advocate its most immediate measures without fear of any action on the part of the university, and then the Federal Bureau of Investigation and other police agencies will be able to claim with some show of force that since the university is not carrying out the most minimal safeguards of democracy, that they have the right to infiltrate our premises with their agents. We will then truly become a police university.
It has been suggested that any restriction on speech or advocacy or organization that is allowed on this campus by the administration will inevitably mean the policing and perhaps the prior censorship of all such speech and advocacy, and perhaps the prior restriction of all such organization. I would like to point out that, in my understanding, these are principles that govern the situation. The university still retains the right to act under circumstances that are outrageous and detrimental to free speech and democracy. I think it is not too difficult to envisage a situation where, without trying to raise anybody's hair, force and violence is directly organized on the campus, and the campus has, and the administration or the student committee governing this has no recourse at all in such a situation, either in terms of forbidding such activity or in terms of disciplining anyone involved in it.
Render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's, and render unto the university that which belongs to the university. As to the substance of what men say, this place should be absolutely free. So far as the university is concerned, this is an educational institution. We are engaged in the business of education. That function carries us into lots of areas of thought and even some areas of activity. We're concerned with knowing ourselves, with discovering knowledge, with spreading knowledge, with developing among our students some sense of morality and some capacity for self-government in a democracy. All of this requires that we adhere to standards which will permit people to say what is on their minds. We should not forbid them to say anything. All right, now, our concern is not violence. This is the concern of the civil community. This is the concern of the FBI. And if Professor Foyer thinks that the FBI does not now have a right to come on this campus, he better think again. We should leave all these matters of restriction of content to the civil society, where constitutional restraints will be imposed on those who act to invade freedom of speech. We should be concerned with the intellectual and spiritual task of running a university where anybody can say whatever is on his mind, and other people can listen to him and think about it and make up their minds whether they agree or not. This resolution is not just a declaration of principle, this proposal that Dr. Foyer is making. It opens up to university regulation what we are here saying should not be regulated by the university in any manner, shape, or form.
The Senate then took two votes. The first was on the amendment, and the Senate defeated it, 737 against and 284 in favor. The second vote was on the motion itself.
I ask that those all in favor of the motion please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no.
No.
The motion is carried. If there is a call for a division, we will have a count. All right, well, you heard the call.
There was a pause as the tally was taken. Then...
The secretary, please announce the vote.
Mr. Chairman, the vote is 824 aye, 115 nay.
The entire Senate meeting had been broadcast through a public address system outside the building, and hundreds of students stood listening as the vote count was announced.
Chairman, vote is 824 aye, 115 nay.
The free speech movement and its supporters greeted the Academic Senate's action as a victory, and Mario Savio called it magnificent, a victory for the FSM and for the university. But the long-range effect of the action cannot yet be judged. By its vote, the Senate took a step into uncharted areas and now faces new kinds of problems, not only within the university, but in relations between the university and the rest of society. The University of California is a semi-autonomous organ of the state, subject ultimately to the state legislature. In addition, the Senate's action does not, by itself, change the administrative system. It only asks the Board of Regents to make that change. At the moment of the Senate's action, it appeared to both faculty and students to be the only means to achieve peace at the university. But the total effect of the Senate's action depends on what President Kerr has called the university's many publics, and an answer to the question, will it succeed, lies in the future.
That was the 1965 radio documentary on the Sproul Hall sit-ins and the free speech movement entitled Is Freedom Academic? This is from The Vault.